The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
How do you tell the story of the American Revolution in six lives? Russell Shorta will join us to discuss his latest book, Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. What distinguished Arthur Schlesinger Jr. among 20th century historians? Richard Aldous will be here to talk about his new biography, Schlesinger, the Imperial Historian. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Russell Shorta joins us now. He is the best-selling author of The Island at the Center of the World, among other books, and his latest book is called Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Russell, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Pamela, for having me here.
So this is a book about the American Revolution, but as told through the lives of six people. And I'm curious, did you know that you wanted to write with that approach first, or was it that you wanted to write about the American Revolution and this is how you thought best to do it?
A confession, the American Revolution never really grabbed me, which I guess if I want to blame someone, I'll blame my junior high school history teachers. I wrote a book 13 years ago, The Island at the Center of the World, about Dutch New York. So that's a book of the 1600s. Mm-hmm. And I basically ever since then, that has been my period, the 1600s. But moving forward from there in time, I think in the back of my mind, I kind of decade by decade move forward. And when I came at the revolution from the other side, it started to come to life for me. And the idea that came to me was not to write the story that we all know and that we always seem to get, which is has to do with the men with the powdered wigs and the, and the quill pens, but it was supposedly for everyone, this new republic. So how did it feel? How did it play out for people at different levels of society? And I thought, therefore, also that might have some relevance today because we still, despite the fact that the promises of the revolution are not fully fulfilled for everyone, we all know that's the ideal, that it's for everyone.
So you did still include two men in powdered wigs among your six.
Indeed.
Let's talk about who the six people were that you chose, starting with the powdered wigs, because they're probably the most obvious of the choices. And then I'd love to hear about the process that you must have gone through to pick these six people.
George Washington was actually the last of the six puzzle pieces to fit.
Really? Were you fighting the...
I guess I was. I guess he seemed too obvious to consider. And I'll tell you how far back this idea was germinating in my mind. I was originally was thinking that my powdered wig American patriot would be Hamilton because I was thinking, well, he doesn't get it.
Darn.
Nobody ever talks about Hamilton.
Someone took that idea.
No, but it even before then, I had switched because Washington actually becomes the one who is the conduit to, he links so many of the others. And he's a fascinatingly enigmatic figure. And George Germain is the other powdered wig you're referring to. He is a British aristocrat. I was attracted to him because he is such an aggressive proponent of British feudalism. He was a member of the aristocracy. He was very aggressive in promoting British interests and his own. He was an ardent military officer, and he infamously, in battle in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, he disgraced himself. He was tried for, almost executed for treason. And so he fell from grace in the 1750s, and then spent the next 20 years laboriously working himself back up into a position of power, and was appointed the American Secretary, the Secretary of State for the Americas, just on the eve of the American Revolution. So he was handed the task of fighting this rebellion against basically everything he stood for, and he did it with this very personal motivation, because his enemies in Parliament still called him the coward of Minden, the battle at which he disgraced himself.
So only to be disgraced again, of
exactly.
course. Okay, let's talk about the other four then, because they're not well-known figures, I think, for most people.
Right.
And let's start with Corn Planter, the Seneca chief. I'm going to mess up this pronunciation in Seneca. Is it?
Kayetwake.
I was definitely going to say that wrong, so thank you for saying it who was he, and why did you include him in this narrative?
You have your stereotypical image of a Native American warrior, and he was that, but he was many other things, too. He was a complicated, I call him in the book, a philosophical figure. He understood compromise. He understood the complexity of the situation that his people, the Seneca, the Iroquois Confederacy, were in. He argues against siding with the British in these councils that the Iroquois had. He was overruled. And then he, understanding, okay, majority rule, we go with the will of the people, he fights viciously against the Americans, attacking American villages and forts. And then after the war, when the British and therefore the Iroquois lose, they appoint him the one to go to the Americans and negotiate. And it's an impossible position. He does his best. He gets what he can. He meets with Washington and others, comes back, and his people are so disgruntled with him that he then goes to the Americans and asks for a bodyguard because he's afraid of retribution from his own people. So over and over again, you see him having to deal with the very real world complexities, and in his own being too. His father was actually a white man. He was a Dutch American from Albany, an Indian trader. So from his childhood, he is treated differently.
Was that unusual for someone who was
mixed?
It was
pretty unusual, yeah.
Raised to become the chief of a Native American?
Well, he wasn't technically a chief, but his mother was what is called a lineage matron. So because his mother was an important person, he could become a leader if he excelled. It was unusual enough that when he was a child, other kids made fun of him because of the color of his skin. His father is always this absence in his life. Mm-hmm. And a couple times in his life, he makes a pilgrimage to meet his father and to try to get some satisfaction from him. I wanted to pick people who you could feel, even though with a Native American, it's what you're getting is processed through layers of white interpretation. In the transcriptions of interviews and things, you can feel this person struggling with his own who am I kind of thing in the midst of this great war.
What was his meeting with Washington like, and did either of them leave any record of their impression of the other?
He had two meetings with Washington, and he seems to have had a high regard for Washington, in part because he was the victor. I mean, you have to give him credit, that kind of thing. And the last one, it's very poignant because by that time, they tried and failed to negotiate for more land, more of the land that had been theirs, the Seneca and the Iroquois, the land that had been theirs. And they are basically forced to agree to sell. And by this point, he's trying to understand, and he has been steadily agreeing to the ways of the whites, having Iroquois children learn English and so on. And so what he says to Washington is, okay, so we sell our land, and you give us money for it. I've heard of these things called banks, and if I take your money and give it to the bank, am I right in understanding that it will be safe so that our young men won't waste the money and we can use that money somehow to... So he's asking Washington, can you help me to understand this?
Right.
Because this is the position I'm in. So that's what I mean about this personality. You can see a personality, you can see him working in real time with these very complicated issues.
You included one woman among your six, Margaret Moncrief Coghlan. Why her? Who is she?
Why her? Because she broke gender norms. This book is really about freedom and how it plays out in different ways. We think of the American Revolution as being about political freedom. It was actually part of this much wider wave of individual freedom. And freedom for women, I mean, to talk about a women's movement at that time would be very anachronistic, but there was a cutting edge at that moment, which had to do with people in newspapers, and there were plays written about women should not be subjected to forced marriage. And that was exactly her situation. And she rebelled against it, trying to go with the tenor of the time, saying, no, this is what the character in the play does. She rejects that.
And she was only 14.
She was 14 at the time, yeah. And this was in New York at Trinity Church in the midst of the Revolutionary War, in the midst of this battle for New York.
So what was her background and who was she being forced to marry?
She was the daughter of an officer who the American officers thought would side with them, but he sided with the British.
So you got three of these six, in a way, siding with the British.
In one way or another, yeah. And she therefore took on his loyalties.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a moment when she is kind of caught behind enemy lines with Washington and the other officers on Manhattan while the British forces are amassing on Staten Island and her father is over there. And the Americans are trying to figure out a way to get her over to him. And she's at a dinner and the toast is given and she won't go along with the toast to the Continental Congress. She toasts General Howe, the British general, and Washington is scandalized. I tried to find people who interact with one another and so that it really does read as one book and you get to these moments in the book where different of these people suddenly their paths cross. So this was a very nice moment where this bold girl is defying the most powerful of the Americans in this very kind of public way. But she, so her father forces her to marry a young British officer who mm-hmm. she immediately recognizes as a cad, and he was. And she finally relents and marries him, but can't stand it, and she runs away from him. She's a very dramatic personality, which you have to be drawn to
right.
that as a writer.
How unusual was it to do that at the time among sort of her class and women that age?
It was very unusual, and when you did it as a woman, what options did you have left? She managed to make out a career for herself as kind of a serial mistress to important men
mm-hmm.
in England and then in Paris. She ends up in Paris on the eve of the French Revolution. And for a time, she's making it work. I mean, she was doing it in real time. I think we would say from our perspective that she was trying to make a go of it. She was trying to have a life of independence, which was largely impossible. And I think her role models were mistresses of prominent men and actresses. These were two kind of categories where a woman could sort of on her own try to stand out and make her way.
And how do we know? What's the historical record of her? How do we know about her exploits?
She wrote a memoir, mm-hmm. I think largely to get back at her husband, but also trying to raise money. She was always in debt because she would spend lavishly. And using that, then I compiled a sort of a scaffold of other sources. The few historians who've written about her in the past took it for granted that she died in 1787 for the very good reason that her obituary appears in London newspapers then. I knew that that was wrong. I felt that that was wrong, but I had to find evidence. And I have since found three letters that she wrote, and I know her handwriting and everything, dated after that.
So I'm curious about your process in choosing these individuals, because obviously there were many women that you could choose from at
sure.
the time and many Native American warriors to choose from. What was that process like?
I didn't have exact slots. I mean, I knew I wanted to have at least one woman. I wanted to have two women, but then, you know, you're doing this, the juggling of puzzle pieces. I knew I needed to have one person who was trapped in slavery. I wanted one of the powdered wigs. I spent about 2 years kind of auditioning people
mm-hmm.
and, you know, hundreds of people.
Was it hard to let go of some of the ones?
It was hard to let go. And in some cases, it was easy. The people would kind of jump out at you eventually. Mm-hmm. With the case, for example, of Venture Smith, the slave, there's a category called slave narratives. So you think, okay, great, here's lots of choices. As you start reading through them, you realize there's a sameness,
mm-hmm.
and that's because most of them were created by abolitionists who went around interviewing people who had been slaves or were
right.
slaves to support the cause. But they put this overlay. It's a very kind of moralizing, Christian, flattening tone, and that kind of, then you feel like I'm not getting the person.
Right.
Venture Smith's narrative, which he dictated near the end of his life, kind of stands out from the pack. It's a voice. It's a strong voice. He never learned to read and write himself, but he must have, you know, had the say over the final manuscript. He knows what he's about. He's born in West Africa, the son of a local prince captured into slavery by an African slaving army, which then is beaten by another slaving army and then finally taken to the coast and sold to the ship that happens to be in the harbor, is from Newport, Rhode Island. And so he ends up in New England. He is on Fisher's Island in Long Island Sound and then mm-hmm. in Connecticut for most of his life. And he's a very transactional figure. He calculates everything. He reckons everything in terms of dollars and cents. When he talks about his daughter getting ill, he doesn't say, oh, thank God she survived. He says, you know, I had to pay the doctor 40 pounds.
Right.
And he very cagily buys himself and his family out of slavery. And what I mean by cagey is he several times he changes owners. And the last time he gets himself into the position where he is able to sort of interview different prospective owners. And he settles on the one who he has agreed in advance with will allow him the opportunity to buy himself and his family. So he does that. And even the way he does it, he first buys himself and then his two sons out of slavery, and then his wife and daughter, because he's reckoning his two sons can work alongside him, they can save up money faster and get the wife and daughter out.
And he ended up a landowner with a house and a...
He ended up with more than 100 acres of land in rural Connecticut in a town called Haddam. And every year there, there's a Venture Smith Day. I was just there in September. And
it's all his descendants or?
His descendants come. I actually went to Ghana when I was researching the book. I wanted to go to Ghana to Anamabo, the fort where he was processed. And I found out that descendants of his were planning a trip there. So I went with them. And it was a remarkable experience. Had they ever been? Most of them hadn't had passports before.
Wow.
And most of them still live in New England. They haven't fallen too far from the tree. And he was such a remarkable figure that every generation passed down stories of him. And the father of the people who were sort of my age, who I went with, had always wanted to go and never made it. So his children, they brought with them a vial containing some of the soil from Venture Smith's grave and their father's ashes, and they sprinkled them there on the shore near the fort. So it was really a remarkable experience.
And yet, he's not a household name.
Right.
How did you come across that narrative?
Well, as I say, you go looking through the slave narratives, and I mean, there's quite a lot of them, but I mean, it's a finite number, and this one really is different. I mean, and it's clearly not done through the abolitionist mill, you know.
So his life intersected with who among the other five characters?
You know, one of the things I tried to find points of intersection, but as I was and I have to tell you, I have to be honest that while the whole time I was writing it, because what I was doing was taking people who were by definition from different levels of society and hoping that this is going to work as one thing. And even, you know, the whole way through, I'm kind of saying to myself and my wife, is this going to work? Is this working? But what I started to see as I went through it was connection, other kinds of connections. So Venture Smith, for example, the idea of honor in the 18th century existed in West Africa as it existed in Virginia planter society, as it existed in the British aristocracy. And so those three, Venture Smith and George Sackville and George Washington, are battling similar thing. Venture Smith and George Washington both lose their fathers at about the same age, and they both sort of that colors their personality and their ambition. Venture Smith, you know, George Washington had this honor code that propelled him forward, and the loss of his father and the loss, therefore, of a proper education were kind of part of what motivated him. Venture Smith lost his father, lost his freedom, but he knew slavery in his land. And according to his honor code, if you were unlucky enough that the fates made you a slave, you had to be a good slave. You had to be loyal. You had to show that you were, you know, fulfilling that end of the bargain. So that was part of his... But meanwhile, he's scheming for, you know, to buy his freedom.
And his son marched with Washington.
His son marched with Washington, and his children stayed in Haddam, and they're buried alongside him and his wife now in the cemetery in Haddam.
So it's evident how the idea of revolution impacted the lives of these other characters. How did it affect Abraham Yates, your sixth character, a shoemaker?
Yeah, Yates was, I wanted a man of the people. I thought that was, and he was the ninth child of a blacksmith, the apprentice to a shoemaker. And he taught himself law. And he always seemed to have been born with this chip on his shoulder, distrust of elites. He became sheriff of Albany County in the 1750s when the French and Indian War broke out. And he found himself fighting not the French, who were the actual enemy, but the English soldiers who were stationed in Albany. And so that is the beginning of his antipathy toward England and him seeing that England, which is supposedly the place from which all these Enlightenment principles come from, is actually just kind of stepping all over the colonies. So he becomes a patriot in the streets during the Revolution, and he's interacting with Washington And he holds several offices in New York politics. And as soon as the war is over, as soon as they win, he turns on Washington and the other leaders because he sees them as creating what they just vanquished, creating a new aristocracy. And he becomes one of the most vehement anti-federalists. And anti-federalism is a, you know, becomes this striking feature, which I think has a lot of parallels really to our time, because they were terribly afraid of the power of a federal government. And he, in particular, was afraid that the way the Constitution was written, the power that the presidency had, he said that if the president wins the Senate onto his side, if he can cajole them to backing him, he can then stack the Supreme Court and he can become a tyrant. So he, you know, foresaw a mm-hmm. lot of the these themes, you know, these echoes of history. He kind right. of really is the beginning of one of these echoes.
So you mentioned early on that your period was the 1600s. With this book, you start around the 1730s, right, and get into the turn of the century. So does that mean that the next book, we're going to find you in the 19th century?
Actually, no.
You're going to go back?
My next book is about my grandfather and his brother-in-law, and it's set in my hometown in the 1940s and 50s.
A full century leap ahead.
Exactly.
All right. Something to look forward to. Russell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
Russell Shorto's new book is called Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Richard Aldous joins us now. He's a professor of history at Bard College, the author of a number of books, and a frequent contributor to the Book Review. His newest book is called Schlesinger, the Imperial Historian. Richard, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write a biography of a historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr.?
So it's two things, really. First of all, when I was a child, Arthur Schlesinger was one of the first historians that I ever read. I can still see the gold spine of the UK edition of A Thousand Days on my father's bookcase. But from an intellectual point of view, the thing I was really interested in is looking at how a historian and somebody who wants to be a public intellectual and at one stage in his career, obviously a public servant, how those things all come together, the tensions between them, but the way in which they create this almost unique character in American life.
Right. So for those who are not familiar with Schlesinger, he was not only a historian, as you said, but also had this long career in politics as a political activist. He was a spy at one point.
Well, he works for OSS during the during the Second World War. So yeah, that's the forerunner of the CIA, as you know.
And as you also, you use the phrase public intellectual, which is, you know, a funny kind of phrase. But is that one that you think he embraced? Did he aspire to be a public intellectual?
He absolutely did. And in fact, one of the fascinating things that I found in working on this is that goes right back to his earliest days as an undergraduate. That when he's writing his senior thesis, he's worried about, well, you know, I love history, but does it actually have any purpose? So really what he becomes interested in is how can I do both? How how can I have an impact in the world? How can I change things, not just through ideas, but through action too? And in some ways, his entire career is about trying to balance those two things.
Well, that's a really interesting thought for him to have, because he's the son of a historian.
And I think, you know, maybe that's the reason that he has the thought, because on the one hand, he embraces the life of his father, that his father is his model. He's actually born Arthur Bancroft Schlesinger, but when he's 15 years old, he literally becomes his father by taking his father's name to become Arthur Mayer Schlesinger
Jr. Why did he do that?
I think it's because he really does identify so closely. He's having a very hard time at school. He's been advanced, so he's 2 years younger than most of his contemporaries. And this is the way in which he thinks, yes, this is how I can forge a way for myself in the world. So he literally decides to become his father. But on the other hand, the action side of things is a way in which he can move beyond his father, because his father is a very traditional Harvard professor, very distinguished historian, but not somebody who really wants to get involved in the nitty-gritty of politics in the way that his son does, writing speeches for Adlai Stevenson and then finally serving in the Kennedy White House.
So he gets to Harvard at a young age, but he didn't end up getting his PhD.
No, and I mean, in some ways, that's just a different culture. Mm-hmm. That he's right on the cusp of the professionalization of academic life. So, you know, Harvard actually sets up something called the Society of Fellows directly to push back against professionalization. But it is interesting that, again, this relationship with his father, that he starts to realize maybe it was a mistake not to get a PhD. So he actually fills out all of the paperwork, mm-hmm. and he's going to work with his father at Harvard, and then the Second World War intervenes, and he's off to Washington and then to London.
And with the OSS.
With OSS. And also he's writing government propaganda as well before he joins OSS.
His first sort of major book, The Age of Jackson, that came out in 1945. Was he working on it during this period as well?
So he finished the guts of the book just before he went away. So this work had been done in Harvard. So essentially, he was working on the rewriting and the proofs of the book.
So it was like a thesis book.
So in many ways it was, although obviously such as the scope and the imagination and certainly the impact that book has, it goes well beyond kind of what most of us would think of as our PhD theses.
So what was The Age of Jackson about? What made it have such an impact?
I think it's really two things. That first of all is the way in which he writes about this period. That because although it's called The Age of Jackson, it's not just about the president. It's about his entire world and actually what happens beyond him. So it's incredibly ambitious. But it's also what it does is that it's a revision of the frontier thesis, this idea that American society is so much forged by those out in the West and the frontier. He relocates that back to the East Coast, and in particular looks at the role of unions, but also, importantly, the role of intellectuals. So in some ways, what he's doing is looking at the importance of people like himself in mm-hmm. some ways. And so again, that kind of sense of identification.
When we think about Arthur Schlesinger, one of the first words that comes to mind is liberal. He was a liberal historian, liberal politically. Did that come through in, you know, as early as in The Age of Jackson? Is this a liberal perspective, a reconsideration?
Yeah, in some ways you could make the argument that all of his books are actually about Roosevelt, that The Age of Jackson is as much about Roosevelt as it is about Jackson, in particular the way in which he looks at kind of the role of big business, what he sees as the corrosive role of big business, and a kind of interventionist, if you like, an active chief executive, somebody who intervenes in a way to make a difference, that it gets away from this kind of laissez-faire view of the world.
Listeners here will note that you are not American. I don't know how long you've lived here in the States, but did you have an opportunity to meet Arthur Schlesinger before he died in 2007?
I never met Schlesinger personally. Subsequently, I've met members of his family who I interviewed for this book. In some ways, I would have loved to have met him. Mm-hmm. But in terms of writing the book, I think it's probably better that I didn't. You know, in some ways, I like biographers who've got that sense of detachment from the person that they're writing on. Because, I mean, let's face it, he was a very charming, engaging character. But also, I think it's important that, you know, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that actually, it's the younger Arthur Schlesinger who is really the important character. You know, the vital center, the age of Jackson, the age of Roosevelt, the man who writes A Thousand Days and who's been in the White House. Those are his really important ideas. Once he gets older, he starts recycling a lot of material. Many of his books are kind of extended op-eds.
Yeah, he gets a little cranky.
He does get a little cranky. And some of his work becomes anachronistic as well. For example, the book The Disuniting of America. You know, the way in which he talks about multiculturalism, about the melting pot and so on, seems anachronistic, particularly as there are other people like Bill Bishop writing about the Big Sort around the same kind of time. But the thing that I would say about that is that even though perhaps the analysis is somewhat anachronistic, he's still asking the right questions.
In that book,
he's effectively asking, what kind of impact is what Bishop calls the Big Sort, the dividing of the of various communities along kind of racial and class lines? What does a multicultural society actually mean for being American? So, you know, that's something that is still very much with us today. And he was really ahead of the pack. He took a lot of criticism. For example, Skip Gates refers to him as trying to resuscitate a cultural whiteface and so on. But I think everybody on all sides of the debate recognizes that the question that he was asking was a very important one, if not perhaps the answers that he came up with.
Let's situate that book in time. It came out in the sort of early 90s, and then he revised it in 98. Did he revise it in response to the criticism?
Yeah, I mean, he somewhat tempers what he said. And it's one of the things that is admirable about Schlesinger, that, you know, he's not somebody who buries his head in the sand about criticism. He genuinely does think about it. And, you know, if you read his letters and his diaries around the time of the publication, it's clear that this progressive liberal character is troubled when people like Gates refer to him effectively as pretty much being racist in his analysis. And when you think that this is somebody, when you look back through his life, you know, there have been various times when he's worried about this question. For example, when he's in Washington during the war, he gets sent down to the South to report on drunkenness around army bases. But he gets very much caught in the whole debate around segregation, the question of race, and it challenges him. This person who's grown up in a very privileged Harvard, Cambridge environment, and he recognizes that this is another world, and that he has views which are troubling even to himself.
What would he have made of Obama?
I think it's one of the sadnesses, actually, for him that he didn't live to see Barack Obama elected as president, because I think that he would have seen this as a return to the kind of progressive liberalism that he himself had always been attracted to. And in particular, that I sometimes think that for Arthur Schlesinger, liberalism was almost a disposition. It wasn't a kind of a particular set of fixed principles. It was a way of seeing the world and a way of behaving within the world. And I think that he would have looked at Barack Obama and would have recognized something of that similar temperament, that disposition, that kind of liberalism, which he had spent really his whole life trying to promote.
On the other hand, he did miss the presidency of Donald Trump as well.
He did miss President Trump. I think that he would have had two very contradictory views about Donald Trump, that on a visceral level, on the disposition that we were talking about before, I think he would have been horrified. If you read one of his last books on the war in the American presidency, which is effectively a diatribe against President George W. Bush, he would have dialed, if that was a 7, he would have dialed it up to a 10, probably an 11 for Donald Trump. But I think there would have been another part of him that would have been really interested in the populism behind the rise of Donald Trump. I think there would have been part of him that would have looked at those traditional communities in places like Pennsylvania, working class communities in Ohio, and he And he would have wanted to know, what is it about these traditional Democratic voters, these blue-collar voters, that led them to vote for Donald Trump? And he would have looked back through history, his own work, the Age of Jackson, the populism there, and I think he would have been intrigued by the rise of Donald Trump. And in many ways, that seems to me to be, at its finest, that was the real strength of Arthur Schlesinger, that he had this kind of political instinct. He was very much a liberal, but he was also intellectually curious. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that took him to unexpected places.
So this is the first biography of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., but it's not the first book to be written about him, because he, of course, wrote his own memoir, A Life in the 20th Century. That book, though, ended in 1950. I'm curious, how reliable a source was Schlesinger on Schlesinger? And then secondly, did he intend to continue and write a second memoir?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly had a contract for the second volume, so it was on his agenda. I sometimes think that one of the things that you notice over a period of time is that Schlesinger really likes writing about things that he believes in, but he doesn't always like complex questions about either himself or people that he really admires. Like, he never finishes The Age of Roosevelt. He stops in 36. That means he doesn't have to deal with the Supreme Court controversy. He doesn't have to deal with the war. He doesn't have to deal with the question of concentration camps, for example. And with his own memoirs, he stops almost exactly the moment where he publishes The Vital Center, which is right where the controversy starts in his own life. He's a fairly reliable narrator in the memoirs. I do point out in the book, there are places, for example, that trip that I talked about down to the South, where he elides things. He takes things and he presents them in the very best possible way, and kind of uses quotations selectively. But then, you know, he's writing a memoir. This is not history. So mm-hmm. He's not claiming that it's something that it isn't. One of the slightly spooky things about writing the book is that very often when you're in the archives, you see him. That he's been through these papers himself, and you see his notes.
Oh, wow.
That he's taken. One of the things that I'm fairly confident that I can say with authority is that he hasn't weeded the archives. There's very personal material in there that really does not reflect well on him, particularly in terms of his family life, and he left it there. He's very helpful for historians. If somebody writes a letter to him and they only sign with their first name or sends a postcard, he writes the surname in pencil, kind of so that we as historians know who that person is. With correspondence, he always keeps his side of the correspondence and the other side of the correspondence. So he's assiduous in compiling and putting together this archive. But as I say, it's a slightly odd feeling when you're working through something and you're trying to develop your own mind, and then there's a prompt from Schlesinger himself saying, try thinking about it this way.
Is it especially daunting as a historian to write a biography of a Pulitzer Prize winning historian?
Well, of course, because I mean, he's one of the greatest stylists. I think anybody, whatever they think about his interpretations of history and him as a person, across the board, everyone recognizes that he's one of the greatest narrative historians that America has ever produced. And so therefore, to be writing about him, you do feel a certain sense of obligation. But who wouldn't be intimidated by coming after Arthur Schlesinger, at least stylistically? But I think that, you know, he as a scholar and as a writer, and you see this through the archives, is very generous to younger historians. That is something that I kept in mind when I was writing this book, that he understood that there is a process, that each generation comes, and that history is made not by the generation, or history is written not by the generation that makes it, but by the generation that comes after.
Right.
And so he would have understood that, just as he was, I was doing my job.
So for listeners who've never read a book by Arthur Schlesinger, which would you recommend as either the most powerful or enduring or perhaps resonant today, or just the most emblematic of his work?
Yeah, for historians, the most important in terms of impact has been The Age of Jackson. My personal favorite, though, still is A Thousand Days. That I think the way in which it blends memoir and history, the power of so much of the narrative, the context within which it's writing, it was written. And there's a kind of a sense in which, you know, it did create, or certainly gave that sense of blessing to the whole Camelot myth. So this is a book that has a long reach in terms of its power, its controversy, but also the beautiful way in which it's written. That if there's one book that he will always be remembered for, it's A Thousand Days.
All right. One very last question. You chose a very particular subtitle for this book, Schlesinger, The Imperial Historian, presumably a reference to the imperial presidency, which was about Nixon, right? So why?
Why did I choose the title?
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, there is that resonance with the book that he wrote. But also, you know, Schlesinger is America's historian at a time when America is the undisputed number one power in the world. It's at the height of its power and influence. And, you know, the allusions, which very often others made too, for example, Jackie Kennedy says, one day you will be remembered as our Plutarch.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of sense of resonance with the Roman Republic and the Roman
Empire.
Fits
right into the Camelot.
So, so there's I think there are all kinds of resonances there that appealed to me.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Richard Aldous is the author of a new biography of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Schlesinger, the Imperial Historian. Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues, John Williams, Jen Salai, and Lauren Christensen. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, let's start with you, Jen.
So right now, actually, I just finished it this morning. I was reading draft number 4 by John McPhee, which is a book that one could say is basically about the craft of writing. And he himself has been teaching a class. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he's been teaching a class at Princeton in creative nonfiction for decades at this point. And so this book is an attempt to break down, I think, the different steps that he himself goes through when working on these 20, 30,000 word pieces for The New Yorker, as well as his own books. And draft number 4 refers to the draft where he is really doing the fine tuning, looking through words that could be improved. But the book itself starts with sort of a general sense of how structure works and how important structure is, and includes all kinds of diagrams, which are kind of fascinating.
Was there like one thing, one great piece of writing advice that you came away with?
There's a lot of really great bits of information and I think helpful tips. I mean, you know, he does, the way that he talks about structure, I think, is really interesting. I mean, I think it's funny because on the one hand, I think it's super helpful. But on the other hand, I feel like there's a way in which I could never write that way.
Because it's so self-conscious.
Scientific almost.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's funny because later in the end, he does say that his first draft, he just throws a bunch of stuff on the page. But then the first chapter does say that he really takes a more methodical look and tries to really map things out. And he used to use index cards, and then now he uses this program called K-Edit, which I think doesn't even really exist anymore. He somehow managed to get a hold
it
of it.
It sounds so advanced, yeah. But it's
right.
like a 1998 1980.
Wow. I really think it's like from...
It's an Atari 2600 program.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of these things where he knows the guy who maintains the software.
Oh, God,
and
that's a great story in and of itself.
Oh, yeah. No, the story
that friend's
about,
like, look, just please write about my software. It's really gone out of fashion.
Well, and also the guy who maintains the software is basically like, I don't want to really have new people wanting to use the software because, you know, I think
it's time is done.
But for McPhee, it's really essential to his process. You know, he also has like a very nice chapter on out-of-date frames of reference, which I think is kind of funny because it is true that there's a way in which I think, you know, when you're writing something and you want to use a metaphor that sounds current or a simile that sounds current, you can refer to something in the pop culture that nobody else really understands. McPhee had a piece where he wrote that one of the people in the piece had a very, quote-unquote, sincere mustache. But it's funny because I think, you know, what, 15 years
days,
ago? 15 years
all
ago,
ironic.
It was all ironic.
We call them
right, there was no such thing as
no.
sincere mustache. Except on, like, John Bolton.
Right. So, you know, I think it's... There's something about that that's, I think, very helpful to keep in mind. So,
all right. Lauren?
So I am about three quarters of the way through Naomi Alderman's The Power, which has just gotten so much attention lately. And it's a science fiction novel about, you know, that reimagines the world. And I mean, literally the world. I mean, this really touches pretty much every corner of the globe. The contemporary world with really ambitious female politicians and young women who are sort of threatened by rape and just, you know, everything that's kind of going on in our current world, except women are suddenly, young girls and eventually women are born with this ability or, you know, afflicted with this new ability that they can't control.
Or empowered with this new
yes,
ability.
Yes, empowered of sort of an electrical current that they can use as a weapon. So it can either be a force of good or evil. And what's interesting is some of the women, you know, have it more strongly than others, and some can control it, some can't. And so it becomes this, I guess, this vehicle to completely shift the balance of power in the world. So everything from, you know, women beating their male opponents in political fights because of this power to, you know, young girls no longer being threatened by the, you know, the boys and men who would hurt them because they have this ability to sort of fend this off. So one of the things that it's, you know, on the surface, it's so fascinating the way in which everything changes when women have this new ability to defend themselves in ways that men can't. But what struck me as so interesting was also the ways in which things don't change in, because of this power, that men yet, you know, even though everyone is aware that women are able to kind of, you know, maim or kill them at any given moment, there's still this attitude that persists that men still, the men in the novel, in this thought experiment, still yet, you can't imagine a world in which men wouldn't see
they feel the
women.
Absence of power.
Absolutely.
So and a lot of men get maimed and killed.
Yes.
Right. I was going to say, but they don't adjust their behavior accordingly.
Well, they still try to attack women. They still, you know, there's still the intent and the sort of demeaning kind of arrogance that's also almost heightened by this new antagonism towards women.
But there's also this, like, this level of, like, astonishment. There's this amazing framing device in this book. It starts off, the sort of conceit is that the book itself is written by a man whose name is an anagram
of
Naomi Alderman. It's like Neil something. And he's writing a letter to Naomi showing her this draft of his book. And you realize there's something odd in his language. And then there's something a little bit odd in her language and her response. And what she's doing in the Naomi letter is writing it from a newly empowered female position. And the man is writing it from a newly disempowered male point of view so that his is approaching her as the authority figure. He is, like, being kind of humble, not overreaching, being like, I'm not entirely sure that I've achieved what I meant to achieve. Mm-hmm. And then she is very generous and yet slightly condescending.
Noblesse oblige.
She's like, this is really great. And I love the little, like, the man thing with the fights that you put in and those, like, little male skirmishes with the boys. And I really love that you kind of represent that group in that way. But it's not heavy-handed. It's such, you know, it could have been very, you could do that in a really cartoonish way, but she does it in a way that you're like, there's something wrong with these letters. And then, of course, you realize what it is.
I didn't know that about the framing of it. That's interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things I just loved is that, you know, it's science fiction. It's a thought experiment. She could have gone completely, you know, in any direction that she wanted, and yet there's something so recognizable about this world. That it feels like, okay, so women have this incredible power that's totally magical and could never happen in the world, and yet how much actually changes
right.
in the power dynamics and the relationship dynamics between men and women. John?
I am reading a book that Dwight Garner writes about in the paper today in his latest American Beauties column, in which he writes about undersung books from the past 75 years. It's called Travels with Lisbeth, 3 years on the Road and on the Street, by Lars Eigner, E-I-G-H-N-E-R.
It's depressing reading his column in that I haven't heard of 98% of these people, which of course is right, part of right. the idea.
Yeah, it's depressing to think of all the people you're missing.
Right.
But the nice thing is that he's at least rescuing a few
yes,
of them.
Yes.
And this is one of those cases because I had not heard of this book. It was written in the early 90s, and the title is a nod to John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, which was a travelogue with his dog. And this is Lisbeth is Eigner's dog. And they were homeless for a time in the late 1980s and early 1990s, particularly in Austin, Texas, which is an area I know well. So that's kind of interesting to me, too. But I just want to read from the introduction because I've only just started this. I'm about 25 pages in and really enjoying it. But this gives you a sense of Eigner has this kind of he's very warm and personable, but he's also very logical and kind of looks at things clearly. And this is not a sentimental book, I don't think. But he says, I often write or say we, meaning Lisbeth and I. Some people find this peculiar, but I fail to see why. I do not say we planned, we hoped, or we thought, because I do not think that way. I do say we walked, we camped, and we slept. I do not anthropomorphize Lisbeth in my mind or in my words. While it is perfectly evident to me when Lisbeth is happy, bored, tired, or thirsty, I do not write clever things she is supposed to have thought. I do talk to her and say to her some things I think are witty, but I certainly do not suppose that she apprehends anything more than I am paying attention to her and whatever she may gather from my tone of voice.
That's
so it's
great.
Kind of, and also, I should say that I've begun incredibly annoying all of my friends and colleagues by constantly talking about my inner debate about whether or not to get a dog. So I feel some
so
possible.
This hits on all your interests.
Some dog-related reading. Pamela, I know, has continued her global lifestyle and has been traveling, so she had airplane time to read.
Global lifestyle, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I did have the rare amount of free time that traveling solo affords you. So read The Power on my way to Madrid, and while I was there, I read Hilary Mantel's memoir, Giving Up the Ghost. And it's interesting because her style in fiction is so particular to see the ways in which she retains that style in a memoir form and yet also the departures. I mean, it's definitely, there's no confusion over pronouns in the memoir, I can tell you that much. But, so I read that. But the book I'm reading right now is Leo Tolstoy's Haji Murat, his last book, I think. It's a novella, and I've been meaning to read it for a long time. Dean Baquet, the executive editor of The Times, had mentioned reading it, and I think he read it because he used to be at the LA Times. And while he was there, he asked the correspondent from, I think from Afghanistan, what book do you need to read in order to understand Chechnya? What's the best book that I should read? And he recommended Haji Murat. And then Dean recommended it to me, and I had never heard of it. Have you guys heard of this book?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
It is so fascinating. And Haji Murat was an actual historical figure. He was a warlord in Chechnya among sort of various tribes in the area. And he had a feud, a kind of falling out, although really was never quite close to the reigning warlord at that time, and decided to betray the Chechnyans who were occupied by the Russians. This takes place, starts in 1831, although there's some flashbacks to earlier periods. And he turns against the Chechnyans and turns himself over to the Russians, surrenders, and says, I'll help you fight against the Chechnyan leader. All I need you to do is to make sure that my family is safe because they're still over there under his rule. And you know going in, because it says in the back of the book and it says in the introduction, that the Russians are going to betray him and that he is then going to escape and that it's a tragedy. So you know it's not going to end well. And the tension is in knowing that and not knowing. And so when he turns himself over to the Russians, he is sincerely turning himself over. This is an honest move. He has made the decision.
Not double-crossing anybody.
He's not double-crossing. He is the one who's going to be double-crossed. So it's incredibly tense. So you don't know how that's going to play out, but you know it's very treacherous because, of course, there's all these internecine fights within the Russian government at the time, which is run by Tsar Nicholas. And the depiction of Nicholas, I just have to read a teeny bit from this description, who might sound familiar if you think about other contemporary and recent autocrats. The constant, obvious flattery, contrary to all evidence of the people around him, had brought him to the point that he no longer saw his contradictions, no longer conformed his actions and words to reality, logic, or even simple common sense, but was fully convinced that all his orders, however senseless, unjust, and inconsistent with each other, became sensible, just, and consistent with each other only because he gave them.
I don't know. That doesn't sound very relevant.
but what's especially interesting is that Haji Murat has his own moral order, which also to our contemporary kind of Western minds feels incredibly cruel. You know, he describes one situation in which he kills the wife of some opponent, and the Russian who's listening to this account says, "But really, well, why did you do that?" And he said, "Well, of course, it had to be done. There was no question." Right. And then he presents, you know, a thorough reasoning according to his own moral order. So it's one of those situations where neither side is blameless, although it's pretty hard to beat the evil of Nicholas, certainly. It's presented
no
by
modern
Tolstoy.
Good guys in this one.
No modern good guys. We'll do good guys next week. All right.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.